Nothing was ever more prepared for battle than Paul's spirit. Or rather, I should say, it was not his spirit, but rather the unrivaled grace working within him, which overcomes all. Indeed, what was said before was more than enough to deflate the ego of those boasting about wisdom. In fact, even a portion of it would have been enough. But to maximize the brilliance of the victory, he re-engages with the arguments he had put forth, stomping on the defeated enemy. Consider it this way. He had quoted the prophecy that says, "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise." He had demonstrated God's wisdom in that through what appeared to be foolishness, he destroyed the philosophy of the Gentiles. He had proven that God's foolishness is wiser than men. He had proven that he not only taught through uneducated persons, but also chose uneducated people to learn from him. Now he shows that both the message being preached and the way of preaching it were enough to take people aback. Yet they did not. His point, not only are the disciples uneducated, but I myself also, who am the preacher. And so he says, "And I, brothers, did not come with impressive speech, declaring to you the testimony of God." So what? Tell me, if you had chosen to come with excellence, would you have been able? I, indeed, if I had chosen, would not have been capable. But Christ, if he had chosen, was capable. But he didn't, in order that his victory might shine brighter. That's why, in a previous passage, showing that it was his work that had been done, his intention that the word should be preached in a straightforward manner, he said, "For Christ sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with clever words." But much greater, indeed infinitely greater than Paul's willingness to do this, is the fact that Christ willed it. "So," he says, "I do not proclaim God's testimony with showy eloquence, nor with arguments from external sources." He doesn't say the preaching, but the testimony of God. Just this phrase in itself was enough to hold him back. For his message was about death. And for this reason, he added, "For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified." His intended message was that he is totally lacking in outer wisdom. As he had previously stated, "I did not come with eloquence." It is clear that he also could have had this, for if his garments could raise the dead and his shadow could dispel diseases, much more so was his soul capable of eloquence. For one can learn this, but the former surpasses all human skill, so he who knows things beyond human capability will certainly also have strength for lesser things. But Christ didn't allow this. It wasn't beneficial. So he rightly says, "For I resolve to know nothing, for my will is just the same as Christ's." And it seems to me that he speaks to them in a softer voice than to anyone else in order to suppress their arrogance. Thus, the statement, "I decided to know nothing," was said in contrast to external wisdom. "For I did not come spinning logical arguments or clever reasoning, nor telling you anything other than Christ was crucified." They indeed have countless things to say, and they talk about various topics, weaving long threads of words, constructing arguments and logical reasoning, creating endless clever tricks. "But I came to you saying nothing more than Christ was crucified. And I surpassed all of them, which is a testament beyond words to the power of him whom I preach. And I was with you in weakness, fear, and much trembling." This, yet again, is another topic. Not only were the believers uneducated, not only was the speaker uneducated, not only was the method of teaching characterized by a lack of education, but also the message being preached was, in itself, enough to cause doubt, for it was about the cross and death. There were also additional obstacles such as dangers, plots, daily fear, and being constantly pursued. The word weakness for him, as used in many places, signifies the persecutions, as also elsewhere. "You did not scorn my illness which affected my body." And again, "If I have to boast, I will boast about the things that show my weakness." Which weakness? "The town governor under King Aretas had the city of Damascus guarded in order to arrest me." And once more, "Therefore I take pleasure in my weaknesses," and then, explaining in what way, he adds, "in hardships, in necessities, in distresses." He repeats this sentiment here, for after saying, "And I was with you in weakness," etc., he doesn't stop there, but goes on to elucidate the term weakness, bringing up his perilous situations. He adds further, "And in fear and much trembling I was with you." How do you say? Did Paul also fear dangers? He did fear and dreaded them immensely. for even though he was Paul, he was still a man. But this is not a criticism of Paul, but a weakness of human nature. It praises his resolute mindset that even when fearing death and punishment, he didn't commit any wrong because of this fear. So, those who claim that he didn't fear punishment not only fail to honor him, but significantly diminish his praises. For if he didn't fear, what endurance or self-restraint was there in facing the dangers? I, for one, admire him for this reason, because despite being afraid and not merely in fear, but even trembling at his perils, he ran so as to always keep his reward, and didn't surrender to any danger in his mission of cleansing the world and scattering the gospel everywhere by sea and land. Verse 4. And my speech and my preaching were not with persuasive words of wisdom, meaning it did not possess worldly wisdom. Now if the doctrine preached was straightforward, and those who were called were uneducated, and the one who preached was of the same nature, and there was added to it persecution, trembling, and fear, tell me, how did they overcome without divine power? Therefore, after saying, my speech and my preaching were not with persuasive words of wisdom, he added, but in display of the Spirit and of power. Do you see how the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness stronger? They, for their part, being uneducated and preaching such a gospel, overcame their persecutors through their chains and persecution. How? Was it not through providing that evidence which comes from the Spirit? For this is indeed undeniable proof. For who, tell me, after seeing dead men rising back to life and devils being cast out, could have avoided accepting it? But seeing that there are also deceptive miracles like those from sorcerers, he removes this suspicion as well. For he didn't just say of power, but first of the Spirit, and then of power, indicating that the actions were spiritual. It is not a downgrade, therefore, that the gospel was not expressed through wisdom, rather it is a considerable embellishment. Indeed, this, it would be agreed upon, is the most evident sign of its divine nature and its roots coming from above, out of the heavens. This is why he also added, do you see how clearly he has demonstrated the immense benefit of this ignorance and the significant loss of this wisdom? The latter nullified the cross, but the former declared the power of God. The latter, besides their failure to discover any of the things they most needed, also made them boast about themselves. The former, besides their acceptance of the truth, also led them to take pride in God. Again, wisdom would have persuaded many to suspect that the doctrine was of man. This clearly showed it to be divine and to have descended from heaven. Now, when proof is provided by eloquent words, often the worst can overcome the best, having more skill in words, and lies surpass the truth. But in this case, it's not so. For neither does the Spirit enter into an unclean soul, nor, once it has entered, can it ever be suppressed, even if all possible clever rhetoric is against it. For the proof by actions and signs is far more noticeable than that by words. But someone might perhaps ask, if the gospel is to prevail and doesn't need words, so the cross won't be invalidated, why are miracles not performed now? Why not? Are you asking out of disbelief, not accepting that miracles were performed even during the times of the apostles, or are you genuinely curious? If it's out of disbelief, let me address that first. I would argue if miracles were not performed back then, how did the apostles, who were hunted, persecuted, fearful, imprisoned, considered worldwide enemies, exposed to ill treatment, and without any alluring factors, neither eloquence, spectacle, wealth, city, nation, family, profession, glory, nor anything like that, convince people with their message? In fact, everything was against them. Ignorance, lowliness, poverty, hatred, enmity. They were up against entire societies, and the message they were delivering was challenging and full of danger. Furthermore, the people they were trying to persuade were accustomed to luxury, drunkenness, and great wickedness. So tell me, how did they convince these people? What made them credible? As I've just mentioned, if they achieved conviction without miracles, then their achievement is even more impressive. Therefore, don't use the absence of miracles now as proof that they didn't exist back then. Because just as miracles were useful back then, they are no longer performed in the same way now. It doesn't necessarily follow from conversation being the only tool of conviction that now the preaching is in wisdom. For both those who initially spread the word were untrained and uneducated and spoke nothing of themselves. But what things they received from God, they shared with the world. And we ourselves at this time introduce no new ideas of our own, but the things which we have received from them we speak to everyone. And even now, we do not convince through debate, but from the divine scriptures and from the miracles performed at that time, we demonstrate the truth of what we say. On the other hand, even they at that time did not convince merely through signs, but also through discussion. And it was the signs and the evidence from the old scriptures, not the cleverness of the words spoken, that made their messages seem stronger. So how then, you might ask, were miracles necessary then, but are not necessary now? Let's consider a hypothetical situation. Let's imagine a scenario where the non-believer agrees to accept our claims for the sake of argument, namely that Christ will return. When Christ does return, accompanied by all the angels, and his divinity becomes apparent, with all things bowed before him, surely even the Greek will believe. It is evident that he will also kneel and worship, accepting Christ as God, even if his resistance exceeds all measures. For who could witness the skies parting, Christ returning on the clouds, surrounded by all the heavenly entities, with rivers of fire flowing forth, and everyone trembling in awe, and not kneel before him and acknowledge him as God? However, let me ask this. Will this recognition and understanding be considered faith by the Greek? Absolutely not. And why not? Simply because this is not truly faith. This recognition is born out of necessity, forced by the undeniable reality of witnessed events, and not from personal choice. The mind is compelled by the enormity of the spectacle. Therefore, the more evident and dramatic the unfolding circumstances are, the less need there is for faith. This is why miracles are no longer performed. And this is the truth. Listen to what he says to Thomas, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Therefore, the more proof a miracle has, the less faith is rewarded. So, if miracles were to happen now, the same would occur. As Paul shows, there will be a time when we no longer know him by faith, but by sight. As it was before, even if you believe, it won't be counted for you, because the truth is clear. The same would apply now if such miracles were to happen as before. For when we accept things that cannot be understood by logic in any way, that is faith. That's why hell is warned of, but not shown. If it were shown, the same thing would happen again. In addition, if you're looking for signs, you can see them even now, though they may be different. Endless prophecies on countless topics, the conversion of the world, the self-denial course of the barbarians, the shift from brutal traditions, an increased devotion to God. What prophecies, you'd ask? All of these things were written after the events had already started. When? Where? By whom? Tell me. 50 years ago? 100? They didn't have any written records 100 years ago. So how did the world preserve the teachings and everything else as memory alone wouldn't be sufficient? How did they know that Peter was crucified? Why would people who came after these events predict, for example, that the gospel would be preached globally? Jewish practices would stop and never return? Those who sacrificed their lives for the gospel, how could they stand by if the gospel was tampered with? How would the writers have earned trust without performing miracles? How would their writings have reached the barbarians, the Indians, and the very edges of the ocean if they weren't considered credible? Who were the authors? When, how, and why did they write? Was it to earn personal praise? Why then did they attribute their works to others? To uphold the doctrine, you may suggest. Was it because it was false or true? If they endorsed it as false, their involvement with it is improbable. But if it was true, there was no need for the kind of fabrications you're suggesting. Furthermore, the prophecies are such that even time hasn't been able to alter their predicted course. The fall of Jerusalem happened many years ago, but there are also other prophecies that continue from that time until his return. Examine them as you please. For example, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. Upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. This gospel shall be preached unto all nations, and many others. These predictions were fabricated. How can their accuracy be explained? How did the gates of hell not prevail against the church? How
is Christ always with us? If he wasn't with us, the church wouldn't have triumphed. How is the gospel disseminated to every corner of the world? Even those who have spoken against us, like Celsus and the man from Bithynia who came after him, can attest to the age of the scriptures. I assume they weren't criticizing books written during their own time.
Moreover, the entire world has unanimously accepted the gospel. Such widespread agreement across the globe couldn't have occurred without the grace of the Spirit. The creators of any deceit would have been quickly exposed. Such great virtues could not have come from lies and fabrications. Can't you see the whole world embracing it? Falsities quenched, the austere wisdom of the old monks shining brighter than the sun, the choirs of virgins, the piety among barbarians, everyone serving under one rule? These events were not only foretold by us, but also since the beginning by the prophets. Surely you won't dispute their prophecies too. The books are with their enemies, and thanks to the fervor of some Greeks, they have been translated into the Greek language. These materials also prophesy much about these matters, asserting that it was God who would come among us. Why don't everyone believe now? Because things have worsened, and we are to blame for this. For sure, not even then did they rely solely on signs, but many converts were drawn by their way of life too, because he says, "Let your light shine before men, so that they can see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." And all the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions were their own, but they shared everything they had, and distribution was made to each as any had need. They led an angelic life. If the same were done now, we could convert the entire world, even without miracles. Meanwhile, those who want to be saved should pay attention to the scriptures. There they will find these noble acts and those greater than these. It can also be said that the teachers themselves exceeded the actions of the others, living in hunger, thirst, and nakedness. But we seek immense luxuries, rest, and comfort. Not so with them. They cried aloud, "Until now we are both hungry, thirsty, without clothes, beaten, homeless, and yet we keep working with our own hands." Some ran from Jerusalem to Illyricum, and another to the Indian territories, and another to that of the Moors, and this to one corner of the world, that to another. We, however, lack the courage even to leave our own country, but look for luxurious living, grand houses, and all other excesses. Among us, who has ever starved for the sake of the word of God? Who has ever lived in a wilderness? Who has ever embarked on a distant journey? Which of our teachers lived off his own labor to help others? Who faced death daily? This is why those with us have also become complacent. For imagine seeing soldiers and generals struggling with hunger, thirst, death, and all dreadful things, enduring cold, dangers, and everything like lions, and so succeeding. Then afterward, loosening those strict standards, becoming weakened, craving wealth, involved in business and deals, and then conquered by their enemies, it would be foolish to not seek the cause of all this. Now let's apply this reasoning to our own situation and that of our ancestors. We too have become weaker than everyone else and are fixated on this current life. And if someone is discovered possessing the old wisdom, avoiding the cities, marketplaces, worldly society, and dictating others, he retreats to the mountains. And if one questions the reasoning behind his seclusion, he concocts an excuse that cannot be given validity. For he says, "Just so I don't perish too, I step aside, preserving my inherent goodness." Now, wouldn't it be better for you to become less intense, to connect with others, than to stay aloof and ignore your struggling brothers? However, when certain individuals are indifferent about virtue, and those who do value it distance themselves far from us, how are we to conquer our enemies? Even if miracles were performed now, who would be convinced? Or who among those outside would pay attention to us with such widespread sin? Indeed, our righteous living appears to many as the more credible argument of the two. Miracles can be negatively interpreted by stubborn, wicked people, while a pure life has great power to silence the devil himself. I express these thoughts directed at both leaders and followers, and most importantly, towards myself, with the aim that our way of life displayed may be profoundly inspiring. In taking our respective positions, we should disregard all trivial matters. We should scorn wealth and not scorn hell, dismiss fame and not dismiss salvation, embrace hardship and labor here to avoid suffering punishment elsewhere. This is how we should defy the Greeks. This is how we should subjugate them with a bondage that surpasses freedom. But while we repetitively say these things, they occur quite infrequently. Regardless of whether they're acted upon or not, it's important to frequently remind you of them. For if some people use their persuasive speech to deceive, it's even more crucial for those who guide others back to the truth to never tire of saying what is beneficial. Additionally, if the deceivers employ a host of tactics, investing their money, using logical arguments, facing dangers, and boasting about their support, then we, who are pulling people away from deception, should be prepared to bear both dangers and deaths, and everything in between. This is so that we can ensure our and others' salvation, become invincible against our foes, and thereby receive the promised blessings through grace and loving kindness, etc., so that your faith may not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power. And I, brothers, when I arrived to you, did not come with fanciful speech or profound wisdom, sharing with you the testimony of God, for I decided not to know anything among you except for Jesus Christ and his crucifixion.